Chapter 16. Trophy Trash. My latest client, Frank, was from New Jersey, an Italian-American who was in waste management. And just when it was all starting to sound like something from an episode of The Sopranos, someone at the company quietly told me that they had hired a new chief of operations, an Ivy Leaguer whose father used to be one of New York's leading labor figures, one with reputed mob ties. So it was true. Everyone was coming to China. Waste Corp was a trash hauler in the traditional sense. It had routes in residential parts of New Jersey, as well as commercial accounts in New York City. In addition to picking up garbage, the company also collected recyclable paper. The company had set up a venture with a partner in Jiangmen, a town just a couple hours south of Guangzhou. Frank had even put $1 million of his own money into the project, but after operating for a year, the business remained a mystery to him. But everything at the venture was fine, he insisted. Before the joint venture was conceived, Waste Corp sold its recyclable paper to brokers on the East Coast, who then sold the paper to Hong Kong agents, who in turn sold it to companies inside China. The idea behind the venture was to sell the paper to the paper mills directly. The partner, Winston, was running the venture, and the plan was to split all profits evenly between the two sides. I pulled into the plant and found Winston near a large expanse of concrete. He was supervising a crew that was spreading several truckloads of recycled newspapers. "We sort better than in America," Winston said, as the workers busied themselves with picking through the papers. What Winston meant was that the joint venture facility could do it cheaper. Workers were paid by the ton, and most were averaging about $80 per month. It was even less than what factories paid. At Waste Corp's plant in New Jersey, workers pulled out only the most obvious pieces of foreign material as the recyclables moved along a fast conveyor belt on their way to be baled. America's lowest wage earners, illegal immigrants, were earning more than 25 times what workers at the South China facility averaged. China needed great volumes of raw materials like paper fiber, and it also happened to be in a position to sort the product efficiently. Even so, it surprised me to hear from Winston that most of the paper recycled in the United States was making its way to China. It was an interesting business, and I wondered how the government viewed all of it. Winston said that the Chinese government liked the idea of cheap recycled paper fibers. At the same time, the country did not want to become a dump for the world. About 1% of the venture's waste paper recyclables were allowed to consist of proper garbage, the not-so-empty milk carton, the inevitable half-eaten ham sandwich. Although workers were sorting newsprint, it actually smelled more like trash. While Winston went through more basics of the business, I watched as a group of workers, mostly women, crouched down between large piles of paper. "At least they get meals and a place to sleep." "They get a place to sleep," Winston said. In most factories across South China, workers got both room and board. For meals, Winston was forcing the workers to visit a shop that he ran on the premises, a kiosk of sorts, that sold things like crackers and instant noodles. The workers had no choice but to spend their money in the company canteen because alternatives were too far away, and in this way, Winston was also recycling paychecks. Waste paper recycling was very much a hands-on business. Selling the paper in China required negotiations with savvy buyers. Winston explained the reason why careful sorting was important. If just one piece of low-grade paper was seen poking out of a pile of otherwise high-quality recyclables, a buyer could argue that more of the low-value stuff was buried within the lot, and in that case, the buyer would insist that the paper belonged to a cheaper grade. Careful sorting helped to maximize value. Its greatest benefit was that it removed doubt. Waste Corp expected Winston to break up the waste paper into a half dozen different categories. Curiously, though, he recorded more than 30 different sorting categories, and this information was not passed on to Frank. Some of the many separate categories that Winston created included one for books that had their bindings cut off, and in the back of the facility there was a collection of old wiring and other electronic waste. Why Winston was not reporting these other categories seemed suspicious, but it was not anything that officers in New Jersey cared much about. They were more interested in what was happening with the most valuable papers they were shipping to China, the office papers that were collected in New York. Waste Corp's biggest accounts, included commercial office towers in Manhattan, and many of these buildings housed Wall Street firms that cast off great volumes of recycled paper. Paper fibers could only be recycled a few times before they broke down to lengths too small to use. Americans were great about sending their used papers abroad, but for themselves, they used more virgin pulp paper fibers, the good stuff, at the very beginning of its usability cycle. For this reason, U.S. office papers were priced higher than similar papers from other parts of the world. Winston was not selling the office papers that he was collecting. He was stockpiling them instead. He took me to a warehouse where the papers were kept. From a distance, the bundles looked like large bales of cotton, though they each weighed over a ton. Trying to get an idea of why the paper might be so highly prized, I asked what it could be recycled into. Winston explained that it could be turned into printer paper for the China market or anything else that required a quality bleached fiber, including toilet paper. I had a number of friends who worked on Wall Street, and I wondered whether any of them knew where all of their desk work eventually ended up. Standing near the office papers, it was easy to see what the papers were and where they were coming from. Poking out from the bales, I spotted term sheets, prospectuses, and financial reports. Email records also made their way into the warehouse, and surprisingly, none of the papers that were stored had been shredded. Looking closer, I recognized the names of specific financial firms, and even individual names could be lifted from the sheets. On the side of one bale, I spotted a beige-colored piece of plastic. It was one of those magnetized badges that were used to open security doors, and it had belonged to an employee of an investment bank. I pried it loose from between some papers and had a look. It indicated a title, Vice President. I wondered under what circumstances the badge had been thrown away and into the wrong recycling bin. Was it about a promotion, or was tossing this piece of plastic into the paper bin some last act of defiance on the way out? What other stories were among all of those papers, I wondered. Classmates from business school were at these firms. I mentioned this to Winston, telling them that if I had not made the decision to come back to China, I might have pursued a similar track. Instead of working to create the mountain of paperwork, though, I was on the other end of the process, considering it, watching it get sorted. Winston seemed to have an idea that these were not just any papers, and one clue was in his office. On each worker's desk was a tombstone made of lucite, one of those awards that bankers receive for their having worked on a deal, such as an IPO or a corporate merger. These symbols of merit had made their way into the paper recycling bins of financial firms in the same way that the plastic badge had. I picked one of them up. It was shaped like a tall pyramid, with a sharp point at the top. I noted that etched into the clear material were the names of several blue-chip institutions. Goldman Sachs and Merrill Lynch were two of the names I recognized. Having once represented a career achievement for some business executive, it was now trophy trash, a different kind of prize for someone here in South China. There was a lot of hidden value in the waste paper recycling business, and it seemed that Winston had his eye on whatever worth he could find. He was engaged in undetermined activities, and it was hard to gather what his intentions were. In one corner of the warehouse, I spotted a recycling category that did not make it into any documentation. It was a large pile of envelopes. They included both dyed and bleached papers. Some had plastic windows, others did not. The only thing that the papers had in common that I could determine was a mailing address. Every single one of them in the pile, though coming from various sources, had a U.S. address. The letters had all been sent from large corporations, credit card companies, and insurance companies mostly. Could Winston be collecting papers in the hope of selling them to someone interested in creating a mailing list? It seemed so unlikely, but I had seen entrepreneurial locals work harder to find even smaller amounts of potential value. Just in case it might matter, I took a photo and sent it to Waste Corp. One of the biggest mysteries about the venture was why Winston was stockpiling so many office papers. He insisted that he could not find a buyer, but this surely could not have been the real reason. There were many paper mills in South China, and demand was strong amid rising commodity prices. Winston was sitting on literally thousands of tons of paper from Wall Street at the venture. The printed records from the world's largest financial firms. Surely someone in China would have been willing to pay for a peek before they were sent for recycling. If not, at least the cash was something Winston could show off to government officials. This was how it went in South China. Winston could use the papers to suggest that he was connected and that he was an important person to do business with or to know. Even if it had been too time-consuming to mine information from thousands of tons of paper, the hint of value, the internal communiques of Wall Street firms, after all, would have been enough. Waste Corp was not charged with guarding the secrets of its customers. The more pressing problem at hand was figuring out why the venture couldn't turn a profit. At first, Winston would not make available economic information, including market data for waste paper, and I had to contact several paper brokers on my own to understand that operators in China were tight-lipped about the real prices that buyers were paying. The waste paper recycling business was known to be profitable, and yet this one venture was barely breaking even. Winston was claiming that he could get no more for a shipment of paper than a broker would pay in New York. It made no sense. While still working on the shampoo and other projects, I was now at the recycling facility almost every week, trying to figure out the business. Frank made it clear that he liked and trusted Winston, but the more time I spent with the local partner, the more I suspected that Waste Corp was being taken for a ride. "Winston is like family to me," Frank said. When I met Frank in China, before the project began, he told me about how Winston had been to his house in New Jersey and how they had all gone fishing on his boat. This partnership was supposedly Frank's secret weapon in the industry, and so whenever something at the business seemed unusual, Frank came up with excuses. He was protective of his partners. The new head of operations, David, the one whose father had those alleged mob connections, warned me that if I was going to suggest wrongdoing, I had to have proof. It was not that he doubted me, but he was conservative, and he knew that Frank was inclined to give Winston the benefit of the doubt. "There's a difference between malfeasance and misfeasance," he lectured. "In other words, there might be something wrong with the venture, but it could just be a matter of mismanagement. Winston might need guidance. Just because a venture didn't turn a profit did not imply criminal-type behavior. At least the business was not losing money," David noted. It took several weeks to get financial records from Winston. He said at first that he did not have any, and then he said that he kept them, but that the figures were all meaningless. What I really wanted to get a hold of were the records of transactions between Winston and the waste paper buyers in China, but he said that these were never properly recorded. The reason he gave was that he feared an audit by local government officials. Frank trusted him to document revenues in a general way, and Winston kept the rounded-off figures of all major transactions in his head. Waste Corp was expecting data from me, and because Winston would not provide much of it, I tried to collect what information I could about pricing from the marketplace. I found a domestic company that provided market data, and from this source I learned that the going rates for paper were much higher than what the joint venture was reporting back to New Jersey. The most interesting piece of news that came my way was that office papers were selling for over $400 per ton, more than double the $195 that Winston was claiming buyers were offering him for the same papers. If it were true, then Winston was taking in papers and claiming break-even, while he was in the meantime selling all of what he took in for an incredible markup. David suggested that it was not enough information. I would need to see a transaction myself in order for anyone to take seriously the possibility that fraud was taking place. The very same week that I had this conversation with David, Winston said that he wanted me to meet someone. He asked me into his office and introduced me to a young woman. She was a waste paper buyer, he said. Winston took a seat at one end of a long coffee table, and the woman sat at the other. I was directed to sit in a chair opposite the empty sofa, and with a notepad in my hand, I was left to take notes. Winston and the young woman began discussing a contract for waste paper. They were negotiating the price on some cardboard and newsprint. "How much are you paying?" Winston asked in a plain tone. "We cannot pay much at the moment," the woman said. "The market price is weak, as you know." "I know. What is your best price?" Winston asked. Their dialogue was wooden. The young woman quoted some prices, and Winston nodded. There was a lull in their exchange, and the two of them giggled. How strange, I thought, and then I realized that they must be friends, and that this negotiation was like a show put on for my benefit. Winston and this young woman were like two kids at play rehearsal. In flubbing their lines, they could not help but laugh. Winston, of course, knew that I was obligated to report back what I had seen in this negotiation, and I think that he was laughing at himself in part because he was genuinely amused by what he had put together. Waste paper was a cash business anyway, and Winston had already told me how he met with buyers late at night, often over drinks. Whatever happened between buyers and sellers, it happened between closed doors. In any event, the prices that he and the woman mentioned did not match the news that I was getting about market rates for waste paper inside China. When Winston finally handed over financial documents, they were as meaningless as promised. There were, though, some rather accurate records for the sorting operation itself. There were no dollar values assigned to sales, but at least I had a record of the kinds of papers that were sorted, along with their weights. With manufactured goods, every product in a production run was more or less the same. In the soap and shampoo business, we knew, for example, that one pallet of watermelon fresh body wash was going to be identical to another. Not the same with waste paper recycling, where each shipment was unique. Variability left room for a lot of game playing, but at the same time, when the broader business was taken into account, the business was actually knowable. Commercial office buildings tended to generate a consistent volume of office recyclables, just as residential neighborhoods put the same volume of newspapers on their curb from one week to another. The business should have shown consistent trends, but Winston was painting a different picture of the venture with the sorting numbers. Figures that he recorded showed, for example, that trash content was rising over time. When I relayed the piece of news back to Waste Corp, Frank suggested that it might have just been that his workers in New Jersey were being less careful. He said that he was going to ask his workers to do a better job of picking through and removing trash content. The joint venture was supposed to subtract a small value from any water that evaporated in the waste paper over time, and related losses due to water content were also on the rise. When asked why he thought the papers from New Jersey were experiencing increasing levels of water weight, Winston suggested that the papers were picking up moisture as they crossed the Pacific Ocean. However unlikely an excuse, he could not explain how this phenomenon was trending up over time. If there was a real smoking gun, though, it was the recorded weight of the paper types that Winston said that he had. When the venture was just getting started, office papers accounted for 70% of all waste paper taken in by the joint venture. Over a period of 1 year, the proportion fell every month until Winston was claiming that the higher value papers made up only 30% of shipments. The business was continually said to be at break-even, though the figures related to the business looked increasingly worse. It was almost as if the business was at a risk of showing a profit and that Winston had to work harder over time to prevent the possibility of repatriating funds. Maybe it was greed, or maybe it was his way of testing limits, seeing just how much he could get away with, or maybe the issue of keeping the business at break-even was a matter of strategy. Winston's plan had apparently been to introduce a large number of small distortions, knowing that his partners would not be able to catch him on all of the minor nibbles. If his partners called him to task on the paper mix, then he still had the fudge on water content or trash content to rely on. The same thing was being done in manufacturing. Factories manipulated quality on a large number of variables, taking small gains out of each. If they were caught in one area, they still had the advantage of others. It seemed at first a little unusual to me. By running so many schemes at once, Winston was increasing the chances of getting caught doing something dishonest. In an environment where everyone is expected to do the right thing, the smallest indiscretion is a sign of moral failing, but China was a low-trust environment. Local players operated on the presumption that everyone was engaging in some level of game-playing, that others would expect a degree of inappropriate activity. By spreading the shenanigans around, an operator could make related wrongdoing appear less damaging. No auditor could ever be so diligent as to catch every maneuver, which meant that profit lost on one shortcut could still leave other sources of margin. Maybe Winston also figured that if he got caught on any one of his small schemes, it wouldn't matter because separately none was significant enough to cause the breakup of the partnership. There was an old joke that used to make the rounds. What's the definition of a 50-50 joint venture in China? Punchline? It's an investment vehicle where the foreign partner loses 50% of his money in the first year and the other 50% in the second. If it was funny, it was only because it really used to be like that in China. Foreigners came in with large sums of cash and left without it soon enough. At some point along the way, local operators came to understand that this practice was bad for the economy in general, and the word was put out that fraud of this sort was not to be tolerated. Those who cheated foreigners were not prosecuted necessarily. The behavior simply stopped on its own. Outright fraud cases had gone and were replaced with a more sophisticated model. Rather than an entire investment vanishing into thin air, foreigners who came in with capital found that their businesses went nowhere special. The money was not lost exactly, but then there was little or no profit. It was a con all the same, but one that was more subtle. Foreigners doing business in China were inclined to say that they were doing well, even when they were not. I knew this from working with many clients whose secrets I shared. Like a gambler, they exaggerated their wins and had selective amnesia about losing streaks, and they justified their adventures in any way they could so that they could at least say they had broken even. It was what Frank was doing. He knew that the business was not a success, but at the same time, he wouldn't admit that it was a failure. The venture at least gave him bragging rights back in New York and New Jersey. While the joint venture did not generate profit, he could tell everyone how wonderfully well things were going for him in the Far East. The result of such a pattern of behavior was that even more foreign companies were jumping onto the bandwagon. If those guys can do it, then so can we, the competition would say to itself. Winston was a hustler who knew the value of a slow bleed. He had not run away with Frank's investment. He kept the money in play so that he could reap even more. The margin that Waste Corp realized on its office papers was close to zero, but sources that I found suggested triple-digit returns. With the way that Winston had arranged the deal, Waste Corp saw none of this potential profit. Winston took me out to lunch, and I mentioned my concerns for the venture to him. By now, he was aware that I knew more about what was really going on, but he felt untouchable. His case was too hard to prove. The most damaging claim that could be made was that he was selling paper for below-market rates, and because the transactions were all done privately and in cash, I would never be able to say that he sold the paper at one price and reported another. At lunch, Winston pointed out to me that Waste Corp's core business was profitable. "You shouldn't worry about Frank," he said. "I wasn't, but the joint venture was not doing well." "The business isn't profitable," I said. Winston said, "Maybe you can help with that." He then made a proposal. In all the time I had been in China, I had never been offered a bribe. Winston's offer was as close as anyone ever came. He said that he would like to bring me in after I was through working with Waste Corp. "What would you need me for?" I asked. I was already looking forward to getting out of the waste paper business. "I would like to do another joint venture," he said. "Another one?" His plan was to start a separate business that would handle just plastics, but this made no sense. The waste paper venture was already taking in a small amount of plastic, and the facility had plenty of space. If I were willing to help talk Frank into making another investment, he said, he could pay me well, and then he named a figure that was precisely double what Waste Corp was paying me for the current project. The message was clear: make sure that the status quo remains, and there will be further opportunities to earn fees. Of course, this raised a question. If the venture was not realizing a profit, where was Winston coming up with money to toss around? It was time to wrap up my project with Waste Corp, and I had to decide what kind of information to deliver. I had an idea of what kind of good news report Frank wanted to receive, but my role as I saw it had little to do with helping foreign companies delude themselves. All of that trash coming in from Wall Street reminded me too much of career opportunities that I had given up. I had come to China to help foreigners get to the truth. It had never occurred to me that some of them might not want to know it. In the world of private investigations, there were husbands who had their wives followed, not to catch them doing something wrong, but to remove the specter of doubt. Frank wanted me to prove that Winston was not cheating him out of any money. He wanted me to tell him that everything was all right. In the end, I shrugged it off. I put together the kind of report I thought I would want to receive if I were in New York and wanted a better picture of what was happening in South China. It included the sort of graphs and spreadsheets that Waste Corp was looking for, but it also pointed clearly to unethical conduct on Winston's part. It was, I thought, a visually appealing report, and I was proud of the final result. In our last conference call together, just after he received the report, Frank asked me who the hell I thought I was. Did I not understand that Winston was like family to him? He did not reference the report in any way, and I wondered whether he had only been given the quick interpretation by someone who worked with him. In any case, he was upset, and when he hung up, he did it without saying goodbye. My fees were paid, which was a nice surprise given the manner in which my report was received, though for the same reason, I never expected to hear from anyone at the company again. The decision to show them what was really going on was probably the right one, but it was also a guarantee that there would be no follow-on project work. I wasn't worried. I had my work at the soap and shampoo factory to keep me busy, and there were other projects as well. For the longest time, I imagined that everyone at Waste Corp carried on with business as usual. Frank's company kept supplying paper at a price that would continue to enrich Winston, and no one would wish to complain or be made the wiser. About a year after the project ended, out of sheer curiosity, I picked up a phone and called Waste Corp. One of the managers answered the phone and told me what had happened shortly after I submitted my report. Frank decided to pull the plug on the venture just like that, and somehow, he managed to get back his original $1 million investment. If Winston had given that kind of money back without any trouble at all, then surely he had made much more than that amount over the course of the venture and wanted everything to end quietly and without fuss. It took me longer to get curious about what happened to Winston, and I worried about getting in touch. A few more months later, though, I rang him from my place in Guangzhou, and I told him that I wanted to see him. If there were any hard feelings on his part, he did not reveal them. One reason I wanted to see Winston was that I wanted to know if his experiences with Waste Corp had changed him in any way. He had killed the goose that laid golden eggs. I wondered, did he have any regrets? He gave me a tour of his new facility, a rather modest operation, and rather quickly into our meeting, he asked if I knew anyone who might be able to send him recyclable materials from the United States. He had no partner in this new venture and was having difficulty finding supply for his business. I told him that I did not know anyone, but that I would keep a lookout. It was as if his relationship with Waste Corp had been completely forgotten. There was not even a lingering hint of reminiscence on his part, and Winston seemed like the exact same person, though he may have been a bit desperate. If there was any sign at all of a lesson learned, it was probably on his business card. It was yellow and purple, and at the top in bold letters was his new company name, Integrity International Trading, Limited.